From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get straight to the campaign trail, where a case of pneumonia has sidelined Hillary Clinton for at least the next couple of days. Clinton's campaign says she will not make a planned trip to California after she fell ill yesterday at a ceremony in New York honoring the victims of 9/11. Today, Donald Trump told Fox News he hopes Clinton gets well soon, and he says he had a physical recently.
This last week, I took a physical, and I'll be releasing when the numbers come in. Hopefully they're going to be good. I think they're going to be good. I feel great. But when the numbers come in, I'll be releasing very, very specific numbers.
Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And Clinton's campaign says she was diagnosed with pneumonia on Friday. What more do we know at this point about the diagnosis and how this is going to affect her? And we should say the first debate is 2 weeks from today.
Yeah, well, we know that the campaign has canceled the next 2 days of events, today and tomorrow. She was supposed to be out in California for a campaign swing out there, but to give her some time to recuperate, she is now down. She had fallen ill at the 9/11, or had a health scare at the 9/11 memorial event yesterday, and had to be escorted out of there. And there was video of her looking like she was potentially falling down, getting into a van, and then was seen at outside of her daughter's apartment, seemingly to be fine, waving and without the aid of others. So clearly, the campaign knew something on Friday. They didn't say what had happened after she had said that she had some allergies with this coughing spell that she'd had last week.
Well, why didn't they say anything? Because former Obama advisor David Axelrod tweeted this morning that antibiotics can take care of pneumonia. What's the cure for an unhealthy penchant for privacy that repeatedly creates unnecessary problems?
Yeah, and that's the problem that the Clinton campaign winds up having is that plays into a narrative of secrecy or hiding something. You know, I think, though, it's a difficult line for Hillary Clinton to walk, because I think she thought that she could power through the pneumonia. There are lots of people who come down with pneumonia, and especially if it's bacterial, it's not contagious. And I think that as a woman running, she's had to balance a lot of things that, you know, maybe men wouldn't have to deal with in trying to say, you know, she's not tough enough or she can't deal with it. And I think that it was sort of a difficult line, because if she had said she had pneumonia then and didn't go to the 9/11 memorial, then there would be questions why the senator from New York wasn't there. I think that there's a lot to it, but certainly that there are that as people cover campaigns, we'd like them to be truthful right from the start and let people know what was actually going on.
Well, speaking of the 9/11 memorial, there was some audio that came out yesterday of Donald Trump speaking to a local New York TV station on September 11th, 2001, after the towers had collapsed. And he owns 40 Wall Street, which is a 71-story skyscraper just blocks away from the World Trade Center. Here he is.
40 Wall Street actually was the second tallest building in downtown Manhattan, and it was actually, before the World Trade Center, was the tallest. And then when they built the World Trade Center, it became known as the second tallest, and now it's the tallest.
A lot of people, Domenico, reacting to the crassness of talking about whether your building is the tallest on the day of a national tragedy. Does this rub voters the wrong way?
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing. I mean, that in addition to the New York Daily News reporting that this $150,000 that Donald Trump and Trump Tower got were, you know, he was trying to dismiss it as like, well, he was using it to help people who were storing things in his building and trying to be charitable. But there's no evidence, actually, that he was trying to be charitable with that money at all. It's more evidence that he took the money as part of 9/11. You know, so there have been a string of things that he has said and done that have become controversial, even over the weekend, things that people may not have paid as close attention to because of the Clinton health stuff. But, you know, the fact that he had said that he would, you know, blow an Iranian ship out of the water if they made an improper gesture, or that Hillary Clinton could shoot someone in his arena and not be prosecuted because right. of where they are now, or that Elizabeth Warren's still calling her Pocahontas. There's a slew of things he's said and done that maybe didn't get covered because of, or as much attention because of some of what we saw with Clinton.
Well, and just this morning, and maybe we'll be digesting this as the week goes on, he said that he wanted to have a debate with no moderator because he said the system is rigged, and I guess the candidates could then go after each other. We'll keep watching to see. As we said, the debates begin just 2 weeks from today.
NPR and that's not going to happen. So,
all right. Well, there it is, right there. The final word from Domenico Montanaro. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Friday, a federal judge said construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline could go forward. Minutes later, the Justice Department halted it, to the surprise of protesting Native tribes who said the pipeline would violate their sacred burial grounds and could taint their source of water, Lake Oahe. The company behind the North Dakota Pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, says it will bring needed oil from North Dakota to Illinois more safely than trucks or trains, and that construction will provide jobs. But the protests have grown to include not just the Standing Rock Sioux tribe that began them, but tribes and environmentalists from across the country. And there have been clashes between protesters and pipeline workers. Andrew Ironshell is a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokees. He's also with the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation in Porcupine, South Dakota. His son Terrell joins us as well. Terrell is a member of the International Indigenous Youth Council, a group founded during the pipeline protests. Both are in Cannonball, North Dakota. And Andrew, Dad, your thoughts on Friday's decision. Were you shocked?
I wasn't really shocked because I believe in the power of prayer and the power of the organizing that we've been doing here on the ground in Cannonball.
But take up the judge's ruling, which came minutes before the government's decision. The judge, James E. Boasberg, in Washington in a federal court there, he said that the Army Corps of Engineers tried to meet with Standing Rock Sioux members and that it was impossible, that the Native Americans did not respond to the requests.
I believe that the Corps of Engineers is out of their bounds and not understanding the relationship between the United States government and Indian country in general, that there is already an existing process for these communications and conversations to happen, meaning that it needs to be more of a direct interaction at the White House level and tribal nations, president to president, as we are two sovereigns in this conversation.
Terrell, your thoughts, a younger generation, and I know you're there in Cannonball where a Native community organizing conference is taking place. What do you want to be known? It seems to have gone beyond the pipeline. Thousands of Native Americans are coming from across the country.
I honestly think that the youth are the ones that are leading this movement. We are the ones who have been on the ground here in Cannonball. We are getting organized. We're getting ready for the winter. I know this was a small victory for us here in Standing Rock, but even though the Fed said that they halted construction, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to stop.
Well, it doesn't at all. It's a temporary halt. But the government did say that it will now invite tribes to be a part of discussions when there are infrastructure projects on tribal lands. Now, look, as we said, the Army Corps of Engineers and the judge in Washington said that they did make attempts. It sounds as if in its ruling on Friday, the government saying that it will go beyond those attempts and maybe, as your father said, reach out through the president, but that from here on out, there will be much more involvement of Native Americans. Is that a victory?
Yes, in itself, that is a victory. We have, over the last few hundred years, actually, we haven't really gotten a chance in this country to freely speak about our issues and the problems that are facing our people.
Yeah. Well, look, the company, you know, behind the pipeline hasn't spoken publicly, but its supporters have. They say, well, you know, this is crazy. This company had all the permits. It had been through all the regulatory hell. It had spent millions going through that. And now you have the government overturning the permission to go ahead with the construction after millions has been invested. And this will have a chilling effect on other companies. Isn't this construction that does provide jobs? And are you worried about that, that, you know, this will have that chilling effect?
We don't need to feel pity for big oil. This corporation is global. They have trillions of dollars at their disposal. They actually only need $1 billion to build this pipeline. And so it's a monopoly that's continued throughout Indian country. The first monopoly was the creation of the railroad through Lakota territory, and now we have this pipeline who is trying to use some of the same tactics that they used back in the 1800s as this corporation of the railroad industry went across our lands. And even then, the process is skewed by inaccuracies. And really, if you peel back the onion, you will find that a lot of the historical assessments that needed to happen did not happen. And so the corporation complaining and whining that their bottom line is being affected, that's great, because we do need to move into a new renewable energy future, creating alternatives to fossil fuel addiction. those are already happening in Indian country. So again, we are kind of setting the bar of what's possible as we look at a new renewable energy future.
That's Andrew Ironshell. He's a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee, but he was raised in the region where thousands are protesting right now. He's Community Engagement Coordinator for Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation in Porcupine, South Dakota. His son, Terrell, is half Ogallala Lakota, half Cherokee, and they are both in Cannonball, North Dakota, for a Native Community Organizing Conference. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And an irony in this standoff, the lake that now provides water to the Native Americans was dammed in the 60s, destroying their villages. Many still have memory of that. Nathan Hill and the main protagonist Samuel in Nathan's new novel, The Nix, N-I-X, have a lot in common. Nathan was a promising writer whose first book was lost when his computer was stolen in New York. Samuel is a writer who also can't finish his book. They both become compulsive internet gamers. They both teach college. But then author Nathan Hill jumps off the familiar and takes us in several different directions. He's being compared to John Irving, who compares him to Dickens. Nathan has Samuel's mother abandon him at the age of 11. She ends up at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention. The book is also about plagiarizing college students, a violin prodigy. It takes us inside a Humvee in the Iraq War, onto a boat in mythology-filled Norway. And wait, is that Hubert Humphrey? Nathan Hill joins us in the studio with more. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do I understand it's about 600 pages now that it was 1,000?
It was 1,002 when I finished a first draft and gave it to a very unfortunate friend. You know, I said, hey, I have this manuscript. Could you take a look at it? Before that, nobody had seen anything, any pages at all, except for my wife.
Well, and 9 years in writing it, but you say most of that was foundering around and trying to do research. Why? I mean, did you reach down a rabbit hole and then realize you didn't know that rabbit hole?
That's exactly right. I began with some material about this character who ended up being the mother, Faye, in the story. And I was trying to tell her story of what she went through when she kind of experienced the 1968 protests and riots at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And I realized that I really didn't know nearly enough about that subject, nor did I know what the plot of the story was going to be. So I spent long afternoons at the Chicago History Museum. I read every book that I could and just sort of floundered around for a while until I finally kind of pieced together a plot. And then once I did that, all of these other characters sort of started attaching themselves to it.
Right. And boy, there's so many. What of the strands did you know? Did you know about Norwegian mythology?
No, I didn't. My mother's side of the family came from Norway, you know, a few generations back and eventually became farmers in Iowa. And we've lost all touch to that part of the family. But I knew it was part of my history. And so when I would come across some of these great, you know, old Norwegian folktales, they would sort of stick in my head.
And so the Nix, N-I-X, is?
It's a spirit of the water that's usually depicted as a horrible, ugly, troll-type thing. But sometimes it will appear to children as a beautiful white horse, and it will try to tempt them to climb aboard. And if they do, it'll run them into the water and drown them.
Okay, charming.
Yeah. It's one of those great stories to tell, you know, like an 11-year-old.
Well, and there's a reason it's the title of your book, and we don't want to give too much away about how all of these disparate strands braid at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. But there are many parts of the book that you absolutely do know about. Samuel is a struggling writer. You are a struggling writer. You know, all this promise, very shiny in school, it seems, you know.
That's right. That's right.
And then suddenly you get to New York and splat. Can you read just a little bit of writing about your character, Samuel, now a frustrated professor with really bratty students, thinking back?
You bet. What Samuel thinks about in these moments is how he used to be a pretty big deal. When he was 24 years old, a magazine published one of his stories. And not just any magazine, but the magazine. They did a special on young writers. 5 under 25, they called it. The next generation of great American authors. And he was one of them. It was the first thing he ever published. It was the only thing he ever published, as it turned out.
Yeah. Reflect a little on that. You know, the guy who, you know, everybody told you were going to be a great writer, you were doing really well, and then you just could not get published.
When I came out of school, I was beginning to think of myself as a writer for the first time, you know, and I wanted to take the world by storm and convince my parents that I had made the right decision pursuing this career. And the writing I was doing was sort of careerist. Like, I was trying to write stories that would impress editors and agents to try to get lunches and try to get in the big magazines. And it was horrible. You know, as it turns out, when you try to impress people with your writing, you write really unimpressive prose.
How'd you change that? How do you not do that?
I stopped submitting. I stopped querying. And I stopped really worrying about my career. I stopped worrying about trying to fulfill this kind of fantasy of being a writer in New York. I actually left New York. And while I was writing this book, for the many years I was working on it, I didn't tell a soul about it, except for my wife. Mm-hmm. Instead of trying to write something that would help my career, instead I decided to write something that was just really idiosyncratically me. And that's what I worked on. And yeah. I hoped that people would like it. And as it turns out, some folks have been saying some really nice things. So it's gratifying.
I'll say. Well, we should also say, too, that you were encouraged as a child. I mean, you loved writing as a child. Another thing that you give to your character is your love for the choose-your-own-adventure books. Mm. They were so big in the 80s and 90s. And there's a portion of your book where, for several chapters, we are told, if you want to go forward on the storyline, go forward to the next chapter. So there's a little homage there to choose-your-own-adventure books. But after that first crushing trip to New York, you also did something else. As your character does, you became a gamer. Were you as bad as the gamers you depict in the book?
No, I don't think. Not. I had to amp it up a bit for dramatic purposes in the book. But I did play a lot, like so much so that I had to. Yeah, you know, there would be times when I wouldn't be able to go out with friends because I had a raid to go on. I would say, you know, a good like 40 hours a week is probably pretty, you know, pretty reasonable. You know, gaming came along at a time in my life when, you know, all of my stuff had been stolen in New York. And a good friend of mine suggested we play this video game together. And mostly because he could keep an eye on me that way. You know, we could chat through the game. And he could just make sure I was okay. And
did it get that bad? Like, how morose might Nathan get?
Yeah, it was. Well, it was pretty depressing. I just moved to New York, and suddenly, all of my books, all of my clothes, my computer with all of my writing in it—all of it was stolen in one moment. You know, and the great people that I worked with at the time put out a fund to try to just get me clothed. You know, so it was. It wasn't a great time.
So play
World of Warcraft. It turns out it was quite effective. You know, like the rest of my life was sort of out of control. But I could be really good at this one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was sort of emotionally analgesic for a while. But I realized after a couple years of playing, the reason that I had needed in the first place as an escape from the real world was exactly the reason I needed to quit.
So gaming makes its way into the book, as does the Democratic Convention, as we said, as does a Republican Convention in more recent times, publishing, publishers, ghostwriters, and Faye, always Faye kind of at the center of it. You're quick to have said that you immediately called your mother and said, Mom, I got something to tell you. I've got this book that's turning out to be a great thing. You are not Faye. You're not really mm-hmm. Faye. But how much did you turn to your mother or someone else's mother to find out about being a young girl in Iowa with a Norwegian father who doesn't want her to go to college because it's showing off? There's no contraception. Where did you find out about that?
Well, I had to tell my mom that Faye wasn't her because Faye is quite a cold character, and my mom is a very supportive and warm person, mm-hmm. but they share the same biography. So whenever I was writing Faye and I needed some poignant mom detail, I would reach for my own life or mm-hmm. her life. And so the town that Faye grows up in, the small Iowa River town, I modeled it after the town that my mom grew up in.
Where
Comanche, Iowa. Mm-hmm. And my dad grew up in nearby Clinton, Iowa on a farm out there. And so I would visit that place in Iowa every summer. So I would pull from those memories when I was constructing the character. But of course, it's fiction, and the demands of fiction are such that you have to introduce yeah. certain elements that nobody would actually want to live through. So some of those things were just pure imagination.
So all these storylines are almost in serial form. Much like Dickens. I mean, did you think of that there?
I really wasn't. And hilariously, I did not think I was writing a long book when I was writing this long
book.
That
is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. I really, when I finally had a rough outline of what I thought I might do, and this was about 2008, I really thought it was going to be 300 to 400 pages. But other things kept glomming onto it. You know, yeah. Laura, the cheating student, Pwnage, the video game addict. When these things felt thematically cohesive with other things I was doing in the book, I would allow them to stay. So it sort of swelled accidentally on me.
Boy, Laura, the cheating student. Whoa. I mean, you taught for a little while. Are they out there assuming that it's okay to cheat and everything's the professor's fault? And
They are out there. Yeah, I spent 9 or 10 years teaching college writing. And I should say that most students are wonderful and hardworking people. But there are enough Laura Potsdams out there that when my friends and I would talk about our jobs teaching college students, we would all have the same horror stories, you know? We all needed to use this software in order to catch people plagiarizing. And the students didn't seem to think there was anything wrong with it. If they could get away with it, they were right, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I always wondered what it would be like to sit across someone who is poised to be a major literary talent. This is what it looks like. A little bit of overnight beard growth. I mean, you've just started all this, your tours and your interviews. Is that a burden to have suddenly this great expectation of you?
I like what you did there. it's not a burden. It's I couldn't be happier. You know, I worked for this on this thing really hard for 10 years, and I with no guarantee that anybody would ever want to read it, so that it's getting such a kind reception. I'm over the moon about it. In terms of expectations, I have 2 decades of rejection under my belt, so that helps keep one grounded a little bit. And I also have some very good friends who've known me for a long time and are very good at keeping me humble. There was a picture of me that came out in the New York Times about a week ago where I'm wearing a black shirt. And very quickly, I had some friends texting me a caption contest. And one of them was, I think, Peter Pan Goes Goth was a highlight. Another one was Emo Elf Spotted in Park. So I have plenty of people in my life who are making sure my head doesn't get too big.
Yeah. Nathan Hill, his debut novel is The Nix, N-I-X. You'll see it in bookstore windows. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you're trying to advance your career or to sell an idea, you've probably been told to craft a clear, brief message about yourself and your work, something you've memorized for that chance encounter in the elevator with the company's CEO. Entrepreneurs have been delivering elevator pitches for years, and now the idea is catching on with scientists. Carrie Feibel from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media went to an elevator speech contest at Houston's Medical Center.
It's not that scientists don't give talks about their research. It's just that too often, the audience is other scientists. This contest forced graduate students to pull back from the data and the details and figure out how to explain their work to almost anyone.
It has to be intelligible, it has to be 90 seconds, and it has to be fun.
Carrie Cameron organized the contest. She's an assistant professor at the University of Texas Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences, where she has an unusual role.
I'm not a biomedical scientist. I'm a linguist. I like to see how I can work with the students to kind of unleash their own creativity and get them in touch with the linguistic side of their science and not just the technical side.
10 PhD candidates made it to the final round. The auditorium was filled with their teachers, their lab partners, and their friends. The crowd was friendly and forgiving.
Can have different effects on, can produce different quality wines. I forgot. Sorry. Can I start over? Can I do that? Can I do that? All right. I'm sorry. Okay. Hi, my name's Lexi Fluber, and I'm a graduate student in Dr. Pilates.
The best speakers used metaphors from everyday life that non-scientists could visualize or relate to.
Hi, my name is Kimia Mamarzada. I work on supposin proteins. So what are supposin proteins and why should you care about them? Supposin proteins
are... Mamarzada also introduced 2 new characters, lysosomes and endosomes.
I want you to think of the cell as a city. If the nucleus is the city hall and the mitochondria are the power plants, I want you to think of the lysosome as the cell's waste plant and the endosomes as the trash trucks that transport waste to the waste plant.
So far, I'm with her. But what about those proteins she was talking about?
Now, in the context of our city, supposin proteins are the waste plant workers. And if they don't function properly, there's a buildup of waste in the waste plant. It makes sense, right?
Although I still can't tell you what a supposin protein is, I do have a good sense now of what it does. And the judges liked her speech, too.
Second place goes to Kimia Mamarzada.
Mamarzada won $350, but she says the reason she entered the contest was to force herself to practice.
I think talking and writing are scientists' 2 biggest, I don't know, weapons in their artillery as far as being able to get funding, being able to convince people that your research is significant or important, or why should anybody care about it?
Professor Carrie Cameron says learning to communicate clearly does help scientists compete at a time when money for basic research has declined. But she says even the science itself requires more interaction.
As we move into large interdisciplinary team science, the scientists on a team are doing so many different kinds of science that it's hard for them to understand what each other is doing and how they fit into the team. And that's one of the most important goals of this kind of communication.
Some of the graduate students said there had been another unexpected benefit. They had finally found a way to explain to their family members what exactly they do all day. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Feibel.
Today we're watching Syria as a week-long ceasefire hammered out between the U.S. and Russia begins. It was designed to allow humanitarian aid in, but the truce is fragile. The U.S. backs insurgent forces. Russia supports the sitting president, Bashar al-Assad. Yesterday, more than 90 people were killed in government shelling around Aleppo. And today, President Assad vowed to reclaim all the territory taken by what he called terrorists. Well, while we watch Syria, our next guests caution us, don't take your eye off Afghanistan. 15 years after the 9/11 attacks that led to the invasion to topple the Taliban government and Osama bin Laden, the current Afghan government may be on the brink of falling, and the Taliban attacks have not lessened. Inayatul Haq Yassini is the BBC's Kabul bureau editor. Inayatul Haq, there was a recent story with a lovely photo of a father, an Afghan government militia commander, being reunited with his son, a reformed Taliban fighter. But last week, the two men were caught in an ambush. Not sure if it was Taliban, but the father was killed. The son escaped. So sad. What does that story tell you about the state of Afghanistan?
It is unfortunate in the last 40 years. We have seen and heard about such stories when in 1979, former Soviet Union invaded. From the same family, there were people who were fighting former Soviet Union and the communist government.
So when the Soviets invaded, the same thing happened. People were on each side.
Yeah, same happened to our own family. We were on the one side and my other relatives were on the other side. In this particular case you mentioned, it happened in the northern province of Faryab in Afghanistan. And they do not know who were the main culprit to plot this ambush.
Yeah, it's not clear if it was the Taliban, but you know, who else would it be? And how strong is the Taliban now in Afghanistan? There have been other attacks recently.
Nearly in 14 to 20 provinces, there are fighting in different districts. And also, unfortunately, those who are familiar with the politics of Afghanistan, here we have two partners in government who fought an election 2 years back, and then now they are in fighting politically one another. So this thing is also helping Taliban, because we have been hearing from analysts and those who are fighting in front lines against Taliban, and they are saying that for what purpose they are fighting. So it is affecting their morale, and it is benefiting the Taliban and other militants in different parts of the country.
Well, we're going to talk about the central government and the problems that it's confronting in just a couple minutes. But there are some 10,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. They're not supposed to be in combat. They're training the Afghans to take on the Taliban. But what is the thinking? Is the Afghan army strong enough to defeat the Taliban?
Afghan army is not capable to totally defeat the Taliban. The burden of war is laid on the shoulders of common Afghans. We are hearing every day civilians are trapped in the fighting. And also it is a fact that Afghan army is paying a price in the sense of losing a lot of people on different fronts. But Taliban are also losing their soldiers.
Well, Inayatul Haq, you paint a pretty grim picture, though. And given that, 15 years after the American invasion, how are Afghans feeling about their future?
If you talk on the streets of Kabul with common people, you will realize hopelessness. The number of people who migrated to Europe as asylum seeker, Afghanistan was in the second position after Syria. Mm. I was here during Taliban rule in 90s. There were nothing in terms of progress. There were no school for girls. There are things now. But as a whole, people are still trying to leave Afghanistan, particularly young people, because lack of jobs is a big thing. Those who do not have jobs, they are going to give to support Taliban in their war against Afghan government and international community.
Inayatul Haq Yassini, BBC Kabul bureau editor, speaking to us from Kabul. Inayatul Haq, thank you so much.
You're welcome anytime.
So it's worth reviewing how he got here. Yes, there was the Soviet invasion. The Taliban ran the country afterwards. Soon after the U.S. invasion toppled the Taliban in 2001, the U.S.-backed Hamid Karzai was named head of a power-sharing government. In 2004, he was elected president, served until 2014, when Ashraf Ghani won a disputed presidential election. Let's bring in Michael Kugelman, senior associate at the Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, you say Ghani's government may fall as soon as this month. Why do you say that?
Right, not to be too alarmist, right? Afghanistan's government is actually a national unity government. It's run by President Ghani, but also CEO Abdullah Abdullah. And the document that established the national unity government back in September 2014 stipulated that a number of reforms must happen before the end of this month, September 2016. And that's simply not going to happen. The deadline won't be met. So in effect, the government's many critics could declare that the government is no longer legitimate. That could raise tensions in a big way, and if cooler heads don't prevail, could well bring it down. I mean, the good news is that I think that cooler heads will prevail, at least for now. But this is a key month because of that deadline put in place by the National Unity Government's founding document 2 years ago.
Well, and what are some of the reforms called for but not implemented yet?
A range of them. One of them is for local elections. But another one that's particularly important is for there to be a Loya Jirga, a group of a meeting of tribal elders, to rule on the status of the position of Abdullah Abdullah. And the idea, per the document, the NUG document, was to have a situation where a constitutional amendment could be made that would enable Abdullah to become a prime minister. The Afghan constitution does not allow for a prime minister. It's a presidential system. Now, the fact that that's not going to happen, that his Abdullah's status is not going to be ruled on, suggests that by the end of September, you know, one could easily say that he no longer has a job because his position as CEO is no longer valid, and because nothing was done to make him a prime minister, he's no longer a part of the government, and obviously his supporters and him will not like that.
Well, but is this just, you know, personal power plays, or, you know, what else is going on? The United States has already spent more than $100 billion in trying to rebuild Afghanistan. What other missing pieces are there?
Well, I think that this is something where there's only so much the United States can do. I mean, as you note, the U.S. government has provided so much support, military and financial, to Afghanistan over the years. And the U.S. government likes working with Ghani and Abdullah, but it's really night and day compared to what you had when President Karzai was in place. I think this is really about Afghanistan more than the U.S. It simply has a very fragile and artificial system, or fragile and artificial government that is united only in name.
Yeah. Well, given that, we just heard how this is playing into the Taliban's hands. But what about ISIS? What remains of al-Qaeda? Is there a vacuum here they're going to fill?
Very dangerous on both counts. And al-Qaeda, contrary to what you may hear from the U.S. government, was never destroyed in Afghanistan. The U.S. Army, not too long ago, found a pretty large al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan. I think the real concern here is that as the Taliban continues to strengthen, and this political crisis enables it to strengthen, as the Taliban continues to strengthen, it'll be able to increase its number of sanctuaries, and eventually it could be in a position where it could provide shelter to al-Qaeda once again. So in effect, one of the earliest U.S. achievements in Afghanistan, which was to smash the al-Qaeda sanctuaries, that could effectively be reversed. And as for ISIS, not as much of a threat in Afghanistan as al-Qaeda, certainly as the Taliban, but ISIS wants to stoke sectarian warfare in Afghanistan, which is not Afghanistan is a pretty divided place, but sectarianism is not one of the fault lines for conflict. And if ISIS is given the space where it could carve out a presence and do some things to try to stoke sectarian tensions, as it did some months back when it claimed an attack on some Hazara Shias in Afghanistan, then you could have that. So in effect, the situation could become even worse.
We're at a more grim place than when we started. You have less than a minute, Michael Kugelman. What has to happen?
Well, here we could try to end on a bit of a positive note. I mean, I think that it's important to highlight that, yes, things are bad, but, you know, the Taliban is not in control, and there's no civil war as there were back in the 1990s. The bottom line is to maintain support particularly U.S. support. It provides a psychological boost because the Afghans worry about the abandonment.
You mean the troops that are they are training Afghan
yes.
troops? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Correct. I mean, that's essential because as bad as things are now, I think that if you were to have a total military withdrawal, foreign military withdrawal from Afghanistan, things could really fall apart in a hurry.
Michael Kukeman of the Wilson Center in Washington. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
If you watched one of the many NFL games yesterday, you probably noticed more protests during the national anthem. In Kansas City, Chiefs teammates locked arms and cornerback Marcus Peters raised a fist in the air. Seattle Seahawks players also locked arms. Four Miami Dolphins players knelt down and two New England Patriots raised a fist in the air. The players were lending support to San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who stayed on the bench during the anthem before a preseason game last month. Kaepernick told NFL media after the game, quote, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color." Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us now as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do you make of this moment?
Politics in the United States is always a multiple-choice question. You do not have to vote for Republicans or Democrats. You don't even have to vote at all. Politics is always multiple choice. The national anthem, I think, is a political moment. And standing for the national anthem, although it is the default decision, is a political act, that one that carries political weight. But like voting, nothing is mandatory. And at least nothing should be mandatory. If an athlete's preferred political speech is to kneel or to sit or to raise a fist, anything that doesn't interfere with another person's ability to practice his or her political language, that's appropriate. Whether it's right is a fascinating question. Is the best way to communicate frustration with the U.S. and its social justice to sit or lock arms or to stand? That's a conversation. But every dialogue needs two sides. And the fact that athletes are choosing another side, that some of them are choosing to sit, has galvanized, I think, a productive conversation on this issue.
Well, President Obama weighed in on it last week while he was in Asia. He said that Kaepernick was exercising his constitutional rights. Here he is.
If nothing else, what he's done is he's generated more conversation around some topics that need to be talked about.
Derek, what are the teams saying about these protests?
Well, most of the owners have been reportedly against Kaepernick. One anonymously called him, quote, a traitor, and several suggested that if the San Francisco 49ers dropped him, nobody else would pick him up. The commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, he tiptoed around the politics of this issue. He essentially said, I don't agree with Kaepernick, but he didn't go so far as to say that the quarterback had to stand. The owner of the Miami Dolphins, however, Stephen Ross, he said, quote, I don't think it was any lack of respect. These guys are really making a conversation of something that's a very important topic in this country, and I'm 100% supportive of them, end quote. So again, I think it's generated a diverse array of comments across the spectrum, but it does seem like, although a lot of the players seem supportive of Kaepernick and these gestures, management does not seem as enthusiastic.
Well, how important do you think it is that this protest is being done by football players? This is a conversation that's been going on with a number of very high-profile police shootings, white police officers shooting black Americans. This protest could be done by any number of celebrities, and it has. But what do you think is the importance of the fact that it is football, a game that, by the way, the audience of football is overwhelmingly white?
That's right. That's an extremely important point. And I think it really comes down to exposure. Tens of millions of people watch the NFL on Fox and CBS and ESPN and NBC. These are regularly the most watched hours of television in the year, in the calendar year. And in a fragmented media environment, that might mean that they are the most watched events among anything else in the entire ecosystem of entertainment. So if you're going to make a political gesture, this is the time when it carries the most weight, has the most power. And in a lot of ways, because black Americans in a lot of industries do not have chief executive titles and other C-suite titles, whereas in sports, sports like the NFL and the NBA, they are often the best players and the most popular players. This is a unique platform for them to make a political gesture, one that they've made before with Muhammad Ali protesting the Vietnam War. He was joined at moments by Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, some of the top sports stars of their time. So it is customary in sports for black men and women, perhaps, to use their celebrity as political platforms.
And in this case, we've also seen a white woman, U.S. soccer player Megan Rapinoe, also join in kneeling during the national anthem earlier this month. Derek, going back to what you were saying at the beginning, though, do you think that the idea that we can't all agree to at least do the same thing during the national anthem is alarming at all? That was something that was sort of didn't feel political, but now it does a bit more.
I think that what is most alarming are the real-world events that have led some black Americans in particular to think that the flag doesn't represent them. So what is alarming to me is everything that's happening outside of the sports stadium and not the peaceful protests of those events within the sports stadium. I think that, like I said at the beginning, the national anthem is a political question,
right,
a multiple-choice question, and there are many answers to that question, all of which are appropriate if done peacefully.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. You can weigh in at our website, hereandnow.org, about this. Derek, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.